All right, everyone, welcome to the Real Asian Podcast. I'm your host, Raymond Liu, and today it's just going to be me and my guest here, Alan. What's up, Alan?
What's up, Ray? Good to be back.
So who's going to be Shannon? Who's going to be Skip?
Skip!
All right, so today we are talking about Mulan. So I initially did an initial reaction to Mulan after watching the movie. But I mentioned at the end of that reaction that we wanted to do a full deep dive on the episode. So we're doing that now. So Mulan came out over Labor Day weekend. It was a premium service that you had to pay $30 to Disney Plus, even if you already had a subscription. So Alan, give me your thoughts on what you thought about Mulan and why it had such high hopes.
So Mulan had such high hopes because the original animated film was so special to so many people, not just Asian Americans, but everyone. It was a story about a young woman who defied all the odds, used her wit, her determination, her own abilities to succeed when the cards are stacked against her. This particular film is a blasphemy. It's inferior to the original in virtually every aspect. As I watched it, it felt as if the film wanted its audience to have prior knowledge of the original film to fill the gaps. Mm. And so the movie couldn't stand on its own without people having prior knowledge to the original film, despite the directors and the producers, everyone saying that this movie is going to be its own movie and cater to the original Ballad of Mulan.
Right, which was contradictory because they wanted it to be its own standalone movie, but they couldn't help but bank on the fact that most people watch, and mm-hmm. let's say to defend them a little bit, most of us did watch the original, right? But I think they were just so reliant on that.
Yeah, and it just felt as if they took elements of the original film so haphazardly just in order to say, hey, we're making callbacks to the original film, but hey, like, if you didn't watch it, you're not gonna get some of these references. Mm-hmm. Disney was genius in part because this two-part tariff is the term known in marketing, is where you pay for a service, but then you have to pay for something else. It's similar to the Peloton, right? You pay for the bike, but then you have to pay the subscription fee.
Something that I stumbled upon where an interviewer asked Jet Li, they were doing press for the movie, and the interviewer basically talks to Jet Li and asks Jet Li, like, you know, what did you think of the movie and what's your take on it? So Jet Li basically says that China has a long history, so it's really difficult to put all the ideas in one film. But in this film, it keeps it short. To me, I think that's the problem, is that they just force feed all of this history and culture.
Yes.
In Chinese culture, you know, Jet was like, you know, how do we simplify Chinese culture? And, you know, these are the virtues, right? These four virtues. And to me, I was kind of like, simplify is just a nice way of saying diluted. And I think that was the problem with this film, is that it was a diluted version of Asian culture. I think they just got their ideas and their approach was spread too thin.
That's a really good way to put it. Actually, what's funny is that despite the fact that this 2020 Mulan is 30 minutes longer than the original, didn't it feel really choppy? Like, it just kind of jumped from scene to scene. There was no cohesion in the story. Like the scene where they're fighting in the mountains. She sees the mountains full of snow and she wants to cause an avalanche. And she picks up helmets. And next thing you know, she's behind the rocks.
Yeah.
What the hell?
The first time I watched that, I was like, wow, she got there really fast.
Really fast.
And how did no one see her go behind enemy lines?
Who knows? You know, like,
no one's watching the flanks? Come on, man.
Exactly. Anyways, I digress.
And we see her pick up like two helmets. How did she end up coming away with like 20 helmets? What they didn't see is that she had to go back and forth and do multiple trips.
Perhaps,
you know. Yeah, no. And that part of it, I thought was really just done sloppily, like you said. So let's talk about the good in the movie. I think visually, it's a beautiful piece of art. The colors were very vibrant. The contrasting colors, it really highlighted the multitude of Chinese dynastic colors. And red was featured a lot. And I think red is obviously a very,
very, very important,
very important color in China. What did you think about the colors and the visual piece of it?
So colors and the cinematography I have categorized as good. So those of you who don't know me, I'm a photographer. I've been a photographer for over, 15 years. So shout out to Mandy Walker, who's the cinematographer of the movie. They really nailed the visual aspects of this film. They made it look beautiful, flowing, and the colors were vibrant, and the saturation was a bit high in my opinion, because you can really see them pop the red when she was in the battlefield. Every other color was muted.
Right.
She was the bright red Phoenix color. And so they wanted to make her pop as much as possible. So I thought it was visually beautiful.
Yeah. And so the movie had a $200 million budget, and I think they used every penny of it, which is ironic because the CGI in the movie is just terrible. I also think that the fight scenes was also very captivating as well. I think very entertaining. I think it, with any battle scenes, it was pretty entertaining, especially the main ones where they were catapulting the
fiery rocks,
over, and then the avalanche. You know, which was the same, similar to the original Mulan with like the fight scene in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
You pointed out something in the way that the battle scenes were shot, though.
Yes, so you can tell watching this movie that it was shot with a high frame rate per second. So I'm thinking they shot it at 60 frames per second. Think of it like still images. The higher the frame rate, the more more scenes you have within a particular shot. When you're looking at cinematic movies, it's primarily shot at 24 frames per second, which mirrors kind of how the human eye captures motion, and then we fit our eyes fill in the blanks, and there's a bit of that cinematic motion blur. So why did they shoot it at 60 frames per second? It's because they wanted to really shoot high frame rates and then use slow-mo to see every single scene. But the problem is that when you take a 60 frame rate per second track and then you slow it to 24 frame rate per second, it looks choppy. It looks, for lack of a better word, bad. And the reason why is because, you know, the 60 frame per second, when slowed down to 24 frames per second, it's still 24 frames per second. The only time you shoot high frame rates is for like sports or something fast acting. And I think the other scenario where they shot this too in this particular manner was in Game of Thrones, Battle of the Bastards, where it was shot in a high frame rate. It's a great episode, but they do so they do it because they want to show every single particular scene, and your eyes make you feel as if you're there. But the problem with Mulan is that they put so much CGI in there that it doesn't look technically correct. And so if you watch the battle scenes again, particularly the ones in the mountain, if they really wanted to make it look as if you're there, they should have just kept that at 60 frames rate per second instead of trying to bring the track back to 24, because then it looks choppy, it looks fake, and it doesn't look natural, or it doesn't have that cinematic feel. So I personally thought that they should have just shot that particular part at 24 frame rates per second to allow a more cinematic look. But I know they wanted to do a lot of slow-mo in it.
Yeah, so let me ask a question from a commoner's perspective. Would it have made any difference if we watched this in a traditional movie theater, the big screen? Does that make a difference?
Not necessarily so, because it may, because then having a bigger screen is just easier for the eyes to take in the information,
right,
especially that higher frame rate. But the challenge is that, like, that wasn't the case. And Disney, I mean, they can't, you know, forecast COVID happening.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So they shot at this high frame rate because they wanted things to be hyper realistic,
right,
vibrant colors and everything.
It was meant for the big screen.
It was meant for the big screen.
And that's the pass that I will give this film for. Obviously, from a visual perspective, they didn't anticipate the coronavirus from hitting. I want to put the original and the live action one, the 2020 version, against each other. I think with any remakes, you can't help but compare, right? Especially when the original had such an impact on you. There's an emotional connection that we just can't seem to let go to give it the fairest comparison. But, I mean, what do you think? When you were watching it, did you say, like, okay, I'm going to try to block out 1998 Mulan and watch this just as is?
Definitely. I tried to give this movie a watch without bias. So I wanted to view this movie in a spectrum of being in a vacuum. But even then, like we talked about earlier, just the plot holes and the writing, you know, and the shows, when you look at the IMDb of the movie, it's written and produced mostly by all white people.
And I also think for if I'm someone who really like loved the original, right? And there was a moment in time when it came out in 1998, Asian representation, not that prevalent. And when we finally got Mulan, a lot of us, right, we were like, wow, you know, like it's nice to see an Asian, even though it's animated, but Asian storylines put on screen, the big screen. But now that we've grown up, our view and perspective of the real world and Asian representation has matured. I think the problem with this film is that it didn't mature with us, and that it literally just kind of updated it from a visual perspective, but the lessons and the morals of it, it didn't explore any of that, and that was the issue.
That's a really good take. This is what I'm seeing with what Disney is doing. They believe they understand what made the original film timeless and classic, and just said, boom, let's Photoshop with a brand new visualization and then everyone is going to love it. But that's not the case. Mm-hmm. People love stories. They love values, fundamental.
Yeah, like why do we watch movies? To make, exactly. To have a connection with
it. To have a connection with it.
To be moved.
Yeah. Like when I, as a photographer, I don't take photos to just take photos. There's always stories behind it. Right. Like the photos I have at REI, like there's always a context into how those photos were taken, the struggles to get up Matterhorn, my friends and the challenges that we've had, and that can be conveyed. But this one, it just seemed like, let's just make it look visually good. Let's blow the budget on visualization rather than the core elements of what makes a movie and a story compelling. It's the stories.
What did you think about the witch character?
I like that she's included. She is, you know, I'm a feminist by heart, and I am always looking for strong representation of women. But I think Disney did a poor job of showing her character arc and growth, right? Like she, in the beginning, the takeaway that Disney wanted us to take from her character was she's someone who was cast away because she's a woman who has powers and in a patriotic society that's frowned upon. And then her quest was to be valued.
So we got that. And that's my thing is like, okay, cool. Like that, I mean, that's not cool, but interesting. Like the parallels between, you know, do you submit to the current system or do you rise against it?
Yeah, they use her just as a plot point to advance Mulan into the next, you know, paradigm of her character. That is, how does that make that character compelling? Right. She's just a plot point to move Mulan.
Yeah, and she was just so shallow. I think she was just written very shallow. I mean, so they introduced the character and then they just didn't bother exploring it at all.
Yeah, and she got shot with an arrow and died. What the hell?
The way that she died was so lame.
It was bad. Like, eekish! Like that's the sound of her as an animal being shot by an arrow. Like it shoots up, falls down. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell is this, Disney? So Raymond, I want to talk about the ugly. So the ugly, I'll talk about the big bucket is the failure, the fundamental story of the original Mulan. Let's talk about Chi. I felt that Chi took away what made the original Mulan very special. So they handled Chi as if it's a deus ex machina to explain away plot holes within the new Mulan, right? What made Mulan special in the original? Let's talk about the arrow in the totem pole scene. When they're introducing those two metal or whatever things on their arms, it's meant to be used as a way to
weigh you down
as you're climbing with brute strength. She uses that to her advantage. She ties it around the totem pole. She uses it to
outwit
the system, to work a way around it. She uses her brilliance, her strength, and her smarts to work around the society to be successful. But in this movie, she's already, I counted to this. Pretend you're playing Final Fantasy VII. You begin the game with Cloud's already having the Ultima weapon, and every attack is Omni Slash, and the only thing you needed to do was just wait for the limit bar, a limit break bar to fill up, and it already starts at like 0.75% full. And it's like it felt like that because Mulan in this new movie, she had all the powers already. She just had to unleash, like
be
the theme of
herself,
Elsa. Yeah, she just had to let it go. All it says is that, yeah, you can be special and be part of the story as long as you have amazing powers. Mm-hmm. The writers of this really didn't focus on what really made Mulan treasured. And I get what Disney's trying to say. They're saying you're already powerful. You don't you just be your true self and you don't need to hide that away. But the film is at war with itself because it's saying, sure, you can do that if you have powers.
I just would have personally liked to see more explanation in terms of what this chi was and where they got this chi.
And they centered everything around loyal, brave, and true. You know, those three words that, you know, white dudes have as a tattoo on their arm in Chinese lettering to impress Asian women.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Let's slap on some words that we think Asian people like. And then that's going to sell millions of dollars in China. And by the way, it bombed in China.
Yep.
Right?
Only made $23.2 million in China.
Exactly. Can I pivot a bit to the two pivotal scenes that I wish were in there? One is the cutting hair moment. Mulan has a point where she makes the hard decision to cut her hair off. And at that point, there's no turning back. Mm-hmm. There's no going back to where she was. She made the decision that she has to continue going forward. And the next scene, this is the stupidest thing. And this is what made me hate about the battle scene. It's visually beautiful. But so Mulan uses her chi to transport over, you know, a couple miles to behind the enemy without them noticing for some freaking reason.
Flew.
She flew. Right?
I feel like at that point, when they were writing it, they were like, you know, I'm stuck. Let's just have her teleport behind enemy lines.
Let's use the chi to make her magically pop up behind them.
Yeah.
But here's what took away from the core elements of the movie. Think about the original one, right? She had agency in her choice to shoot that rocket into the snowfield to allow the snow to destroy the enemy. But in this one, she just shoots him with arrows, and then the enemy stupidly causes their own death.
Yeah, whoever gave the order to shoot a catapult towards the snowy mountain, They deserve to die.
They deserve to die. And not only that, but like they missed it by a large margin, okay? How were they able to hit the
aiming for the snow.
Exactly. At least in the original Mulan, like she shot it off. And then like you see Mushu like, you missed it. Yeah. How could you?
He was right there.
He was right there. And then this one is like, they missed the rock area by miles.
Yeah. Like, I don't even think she needed to put her hand on the ground, which again shows her power of her chi to be able to force an avalanche. I think if nothing was done, that would have happened already.
Yeah. And like, it's like, how do you show the enemy hitting the military with pinpoint accuracy? And then you miss the rocks by like hundreds of miles.
Didn't make any sense. So last thing I want to talk about before we go into break. There's no Mandarin. I think this was a missed opportunity. And I know that there wasn't any Chinese in the original animated film. But again, if you want to be intentional of trying to represent Asian culture, this was your opportunity to do so. It just felt really unnatural for Jet Li and Donnie Yen to speak English. Not trying to say they can't speak English, but it just didn't feel natural. And I really would have liked to see this Mulan in full Mandarin. And I don't know why they didn't bother with it. Let's have it all be in English. And it just felt, and the lines just felt corny, you know? And that's how I felt.
So if Disney really wanted to be close to the source material, I'm going to butcher this, but the Ballad of Mulan was in Northern Wei Dynasty, which is close
400 AD.
Right.
Yeah, like Northern China.
Northern China, so quote unquote, like close to Mongolia, right? Mm. If they really wanted to be close to the source material, they should have been speaking Mongol or Mongolian. You know, Disney doesn't have the audacity to think of their audience as mature people. I mean, come on, Parasite recently won Best Picture, and it was all in Korean.
I don't get it. Like, every time Jet Li, again, nothing against Jet Li, but every time he spoke as the emperor in English, I was just like, oh, God, it just throws me off.
It throws me off. Have him speak Mandarin.
I wonder if that is the reason why it didn't do well in China.
Oh, we can expand on that in the second half.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break here. Let's get right into the politics that surrounded this movie. I think a lot of us are familiar with hashtag boycott Mulan. Kind of just want to walk through some of the events that happened leading up to this movie. So I think Disney wanted to remake Mulan starting in 2010.
Oh, that early?
Yeah, that early.
Wow.
It kind of revived itself back in 2015. I think that's when they were like really serious about it. So originally, Elizabeth Martin and Lauren Hynek wrote the screenplay for Mulan, and then Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver rewrote it. And that's kind of what really pushed the production into Mulan. Disney wanted to assign a Chinese director to the movie. Obviously, clearly it did not happen.
Didn't happen.
They wanted Ang Lee, but then he had another commitment for another movie. So Yifei Liu, the lead actress that played Mulan, basically supporting Hong Kong police force in basically supporting police brutality. You know, a lot of people who are pro-democracy were saying boycott Mulan because how could you have a lead actress who portrays this character about individualism, right? And finding your true identity. We talked about that.
Right.
Almost kind of contradictory and hypocritical. Then COVID-19 happened. So because of that, American theaters, they had to suspend the release of it. So they weren't able to do the same press movie releases that they normally would. In the end credits, Disney thanked the authorities in the Xinjiang territory. In Xinjiang, where the Chinese government basically detained about a million, I think up to at least a million Uyghurs in this area. And so then the movie caught another wave of backlash. My question to you is that, was this movie just doomed? Like, was it just not meant to be successful?
Yes, this movie honestly was doomed. Disney wanted a particular director, didn't happen. Disney wanted to release at a certain time, didn't happen. There's these themes where you kind of see the chips falling as they may.
Right. When we look back at it, you're like, oh man.
Poor execution.
The cards were stacked against them.
Exactly. Like, not only were the cards stacked against the original Mulan and she overcame them, but they were stacked against the actual directors in this movie. But they were like, we can't do anything about it.
Right, right. They couldn't write their way out of this real world events.
Exactly. So yeah, it was doomed because the reality is China is committing humanitarian atrocities with these internment camps, what they're calling the re-education to eliminate radical Islamicists or extremists.
Mm-hmm.
For the directors to thank those authorities.
And the CFO of Disney, I believe, said that it's customary or normal for them to thank different areas of shooting locations. But what's interesting to me, what made my ears perk up about that, it was the CFO saying that. The CFO has to say, oh yeah, it's normal, it's good, right? Because they don't want to piss off China.
Well, the phrase is, follow the money.
Yeah.
The U.S. has relied on China to recoup a lot of the vast production budgets, right? So U.S. Hollywood studios will make these significantly expensive movies knowing that that China has a growing market that consumes these medias. And so there's financial incentives for these studios to cater to the CCP. Back in 94, around early in the 90s, there was a creative import limit that the U.S. imposed on American films, right? It was limited to 10 creative imports a year. As the rules relaxed, it moved to 34 imports of American film per year. If an American studio works in co-production with a Chinese studio, then that movie is not counted as part of the quota.
Mm.
So therefore, it means that this Disney studio is incentivized to shoot in co-production with the CCP in order to get around the quota system of certain number of imports a year.
Mm.
What is the implication of that? The first American blockbuster to really make more money than China than at home was the movie Pacific Rim. That's when Hollywood really began to realize this market is bigger than our own domestic market. Let's start working with them more. And so you had Hollywood studios that didn't have offices in China, all of a sudden start popping up offices in China because they realized there was real financial incentives for them to do it. So you follow the money. They're trying to cater to what they think is the average Chinese audience. And, you know, you have large markets in Beijing and Shanghai that does consume American media. But the growing demand is actually the third or fourth tier cities in China that doesn't have an appetite for big Hollywood American blockbuster movies. They care more for, you know, Chinese-centered movies. And those communities in China, they care more about what the CCP tells them. And so that's why like Disney is making these films and they modify it to cater to the Chinese audience. It could be something as simple as like removing dirty laundry in Mission Impossible 3 and the Shanghai skyline. It could be as egregious as the movie Abominable Snowman, where they show a map of a South China Sea and they completely erase Tibet, which is stupid because the entire movie centers around fucking Everest, which is in that area.
Another thing that kind of went against this movie in its release is that because of the American backlash, in return, China barred mass media coverage of Mulan. That also had affected the box office numbers as well. So here's a question for you then. If the movie was good, okay?
Okay.
If the movie was good, could it have overcome all these obstacles?
It's possible. And what I'm using to anchor my answer is sports, right? You can have someone like Antonio Brown on the Patriots. He's such an amazing football player, but he has so much baggage, but he still got signed. Actually, you know what? I take that back. The critics are actually saying that it's a good movie, mm-hmm. right? And I know why, because they're incentivized to do so by the Chinese. Right. let's be honest
here. You're skeptical.
You're skeptical.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think it's fair.
But if it was like a knockout movie, yeah, it could have possibly made more money. But like we said, it was doomed.
The critics said it was all right, but I think Duban, which is basically a Chinese social media site, gave it a 4.7 score out of 10. And I believe Metacritic, which is basically an aggregate
right,
review
like Rotten
site,
Tomato,
gave it a mediocre score as well. So like obviously
that's still too much.
So obviously the most people thought it was an all right or bad movie. If the movie was objectively good, it would have done well here in America. And in terms of well, I know that is very subjective and how you define doing well.
Right.
Kind of depends on who you are. Fiscally, it did amazing for Disney, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But perception-wise, it didn't do that great. But let's say that it was received well within the Asian American community. In the age of social media and in the age of, I'm going to make up a word, outspokenism, I think there would have been some kind of influence to be had if the movie was objectively good, and we would have cherished that as a piece of art. But because it wasn't, compounded with all of this controversy with it, there was so much writing on it, it had to be good. They just missed the opportunity. Am I surprised? Not really. When I did more research on it, looking at Disney remakes, it's like, okay, I can kind of see why. I don't know why we always have these high hopes for these movies. Again, I think Disney just has that on us, that emotional attachment where they're like, we know these motherfuckers will watch this movie and they'll pay for it.
Unfortunately, like the fucking Lion King remake. Terrible.
Right. So I looked up that, you know, because people had to pay $30, this was basically an audible that Disney made because they couldn't have nationwide releases.
Right.
Yahoo Finance, now this is unofficial numbers, but this is from a third-party firm. 29% of Disney Plus subscribers paid for Mulan. The crazy thing is that 100% of those profits went directly to Disney because we paid directly to Disney.
Yep.
Normally in a movie release, in a traditional blockbuster release, they have to split that revenue and pay for, you know, the production sites and also theater chains to be able to release these movies and all that stuff. But they didn't have to do that because of the coronavirus. So 100% of those profits went straight to Disney. Why I bring that up? We are having this discussion to say, Disney, stop effing us over, marketing the crap out of these movies.
And making it shit.
Making it shit. But we play right into that because to them, by numbers, they're just like, people will pay. What incentive is there for them to make a good movie? Because they know that we're going to pay for it.
Yeah, that fucking geniuses.
Geniuses.
Because they know that Disney has a vault of classic, timeless movies that anyone is going to pay money for. And to be honest, bad press is good press.
Bad press is good press.
Any press is good press, right? So if there's any type of controversy, it's going to spur up the conversation. And then, yeah, you're going to see certain percentage of that revenue be taken away because of pirated movies, but you're gonna have people buying it to get there anyways.
Right.
And so Disney's banking on just people like talking about it and fucking buying into this two-part tariff in order to drive more sales for Disney.
I want to talk about the Disney Renaissance. So I looked up, they called it the Disney Renaissance, where Disney had this stretch between 89 to around roughly like the 1999, so basically like the 90s. Let me name you some of the movies that came out during this time. Beauty and the Beast, a live-action Jungle Book. So the original Jungle Book came out in 1967, and then a 1994 version of it came out, which actually starred Jason Scott Lee. I actually really like Jason Scott Lee. I first knew him as Dragon, the Bruce Lee story.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast came out in 91, Aladdin came out in 92, Lion King came out in 94, and then Mulan came out in 98. When you hear these movies, this is what made art that really defined a generation and really generated a cult following of Disney, at least within our demographic. These are just iconic movies. Aggregate review score, Beauty and the Beast got 91, killed it. Aladdin got 86, and this is out of 100, by the way. Lion King scored 88, and Mulan scored 71. Now, let me go through the remake scores with you. The Beauty and Beast remake got 65, so it went scored lower. Aladdin remake got 53, Lion King got 55, and then Mulan got 67. Again, you're saying that it's a little bit generous.
That is way too generous. I think they missed a decimal point in between 6 and 7.
The only remake that actually did better was The Jungle Book, which came out in 2016. That scored a 77. When I'm looking back at it, why do we have these high hopes? Like, when you're looking at the stats, and you're just like, and let me go through some notable upcoming remakes that they're putting in production. Little Mermaid, so they're planning on, they're remaking that. Peter Pan and Wendy, which is basically Peter Pan. Hercules.
Ooh.
They're remaking The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Classic.
Classic.
And Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, no.
Yes. And here's the sad thing. We'll most likely pay for.
I'll probably watch Lilo. Oh, those fucking bastards!
Because you wanna see and you wanna hope, but like again, from a business perspective, just straight genius. From an audience member, you're like, damn it, why?
It's them. It's a way for them to lower their cost because they have a main story already. They don't have to inject a lot into that.
They don't have to create anything new. Innovative.
Exactly. Yeah. The most money they have to inject into this project is just CGI, and it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine what Stitch is going to look like with how Oh, no. Oh, I can't wait to see Lilo and Stitch, the new one, because they're going to star Emma Stone as Lilo, the native Hawaiian.
I
cannot wait.
Some other movies that came out during the Disney Renaissance, Pocahontas. You know that they're going to remake that. And Tarzan. So, Alan, you wanted to talk about how Disney's handling of female protagonists has been doing. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I've been noticing a disturbing trend with how Disney movies are handling women's stories. Between this movie and the latest iteration of the recent trilogy of Star Wars, Disney wants to empower women. But here's my hot take. Rey's parentage reveal and that she was indeed a Palpatine felt like such a fucking cop-out. It still angers me to this day. It erased this miraculous gift that Star Wars 8, The Last Jedi, gave us, that anyone can be special, that anyone can have a relationship with the Force, that you don't have to be part of a famous family to be part of the larger story. It's a powerful idea. It's beautiful. It moves you because for so many audiences, they now with this wealth gap, wealth disparity, they feel as if you're not part of a special family or you come from a place of privilege, you don't have a shot. Somewhere along the way, like Disney became afraid of showing women as powerful because they can become powerful, not because of some fucking bloodline or to explain away why a woman is powerful. And then here we are with Mulan. She's not powerful because of her determination, her wit, and her strength. She's powerful because she has extremely strong chi. And so I think with Disney, I get it. You're trying to do right, but you're thinking about it incorrectly because you're saying in order to be powerful, you need to be important. You can't come from nothing. You have to be someone in order to be powerful. And I hate that message. And so Disney, fuck you.
Very passionate take. I hear you. I would personally like to see Disney shake things up a little bit.
Mm.
Just to have a little bit more diversity in their writing staff. I think there was only like one Asian writer in the original Mulan. And in this case, there was zero.
None.
I really find it hard to believe they weren't able to find a Chinese director. I think Ang Lee himself said, I can't do it because I'm committed to another project, but I would like to see a Chinese director direct this film. And they ultimately end up, obviously, with Nicky Caro, and nothing against Nicky Caro, but, and I'm glad they assign at least a female director, but you're not just trying to represent female empowerment. It's also an Asian culture. 2015 is when they kind of came up to it. What was the rush? Why did they not take the time to find the best Chinese director for this film? You know,
it's a cash grab.
It's a cash grab. Yeah, that's true. I think you gave the answer. I'm expecting too much of it.
They just know that they have a growing market that they can capitalize on.
The argument is like, oh, you know, we had Chinese consultants, many Chinese consultants during this production to really make sure we touch upon the different cultural sensitivities. And this is me being super cynical. I just feel like they just probably said, yeah, red. Make sure to include red. Oh, you know what? Loyal, brave.
True.
Chinese people love that. And they're just like, oh, yeah, for sure. We'll just write that on the thing.
When can we retire that theme of Asian people having to have honor in their lives? What the hell?
And that is not... It's important in Asian culture, loyalty, devotion, family. We get all of that. Mm-hmm. But there's more to it, right? Give us a little bit more. We're smarter than that. Come on, guys.
Seriously, don't dwindle everything down and say like, why do you guys act this way? Because you're loyal.
Right.
No, I mean, sure, I guess. But I'm loyal because I care about my family. I have a devotion to them.
It's like becoming like this trope that...
Yeah.
That filmmakers can say to say, oh, you know, we're being culturally sensitive. Asian people believe in loyalty and bravery and devotion to family, right?
Yeah.
That's how we're being, quote unquote, authentic. Going into this movie, I wanted this to be our Asian Black Panther. What Black Panther did was explore, is it the responsibility of the prosperous to free the oppressed, right? For me, maybe the closest thing is the polarizing forces between the witch and Mulan. Mulan clearly is on like the side of the emperor, because I think at that moment when they're on the mountaintop and the witch is like, why do you fight for a system that kind of oppresses you, is very misogynistic. And she's like, no, I fight for the imperial city. So it's like we don't even get the opportunity of Mulan kind of questioning it. And it's just, again, the lesson is just spoon-fed to us.
I realize that with Marvel, they weren't afraid to explore mature themes.
Mm-hmm.
That, like think about like the 7-layer dip, right? There's like this avocado, there's sour cream, anyways. But they're not afraid to explore those deeper issues that relay into real life problems in the United States.
Black Panther did it in the context of Black Panther.
Exactly.
In a story form.
And I think that's possible because they had a Black director who thought about it.
What is it like if, you know, half of our people are free and doing well, but half of our people are not. Where is it as a responsibility in terms of true racial freedom? What does it really mean?
Right. And I think with Mulan, why not take more time to explore deeper themes in the Ballad of Mulan?
There's classism a little bit.
Yeah, there's classism. There's
classism that they could have explored, right? Mm-hmm. Mulan comes from like a villager kind of family. And the imperialists kind of come over and be like, we're going to start drafting people.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also like succeeding in a patriotic society that we also still face in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And then they just say, well, she's doing it because she's trying to honor her family and the emperor. Explore that more.
Yeah. And then the thing with Black Panther and why I love Michael B. Jordan's character is that, you know, we empathize with him a little bit. He's quote unquote the antagonist, but you kind of think about why he's doing what he's doing in Black Panther, and you're like, you know, I kind of understand. Like, he's got this bottled up resentment towards the Wakandans because they've turned their back on Black Americans. what's Bori Khan's story? You know, we know that his father was killed by the emperor, but why? What happened between that? You don't have to get, again, we only get the perspective from Imperial China. You mentioned this, I think, in one of our episodes, is that the narrative gets determined by the winner of the war.
Yes.
What I want to know is, what is the narrative of the loser? Because they have a story too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know that.
Yeah. All they do in the movie is say, I don't want prize. I want blood. Okay. That's your only way to show nuance in that antagonist.
Yeah.
That's it. That's pathetic.
They're very strikingly just like the Dothraki, speaking of Game of Thrones.
Oh, I'm about, yeah.
But yeah, like, we just get the face value of the Rorans, and I just would have liked to know more of it.
The Rorans, and I get the limitations within a two-hour movie period, but the Rorans are so one-dimension in this movie. So going back really quickly to Game of Thrones, prior to season three, all we know about Jaime Lannister is that he's a douchebag. But in season three, think back to the episode Kissed by Fire, the bathtub scene. Up until that moment, everyone hated Jaime. But this is when we start getting clarity into his character, and then you see actual differences in a person. So had Mulan done this with the ruins, they really could have knocked it out the park, right? During the last day of Robert's Rebellion, the sack of King's Landing by Jaime's father, that's when the Mad King turns to his pyromancer and he shouts, "Burn them all! Burn them all!" And of course, there was already wildfire.
Beautiful acting.
Thank you. I love Game of Thrones. You know, Jaime was stuck between a rock and a hard place. His honor and oath to the king, or his honor and oath to his father. And he chooses to kill the Mad King in order to save thousands of people. Like, this is when you see the true story of who Jaime is. He's the hero of this mm-hmm. story. But with Mulan, it's like, if they really wanted to show depth, they could have done more to give depth and complexities to the Rorans, but they just chose instead to say good, bad,
yeah,
that's it.
As an audience member, you're put into a position where you have to kind of think about
yeah. it. What if they made a movie where Mulan was possibly towing the line of being the bad person?
Right.
You know what I just popped in my head? What would have made Mulan even more complex is if in the beginning they showed, you know, the Chinese or the emperor like ransacking the Rurans. Like, what if they were a peaceful people
right.
just by off of themselves, and then this fucking massive army comes in and destroys their people? That would have been like, well, fuck, now I know why they want to fight
right.
them.
Right, Bori Khan says that the emperor killed his father.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I would be upset. Why? What happened there?
What if his father was on the Silk Road trying to negotiate peace or open up the trade? Or yeah. Like, what if they like explored those themes to just make us think to ourselves, there's more than just this dude's a bad guy.
And I would have liked to see like the witch maybe end up killing Bori Khan, and she takes the mantle of like, I'm going to be this, mm-hmm. like, I want to take over the emperor's seat or whatever. I'm going to ransack the imperial city.
Real world is more than just black and white. There's a lot of gray.
So the last thing that I wanted to talk about, if I was to take it as face value, right, from where we've come from to where we are now, hey, as an American, it's nice to see an all-Asian cast, Chinese culture being marketed in a positive light. Thumbs up. I've got my thumbs up right now. I'm like, I'm happy with that, right? Like, you would say, like, okay, at least we're making some progress, right?
Agreed.
I have two sides to me. So, like, that one side of it is I can take that and be, like, happy with it. And some people are like, yeah, you know, what are you complaining about? There's Asian people in the cast. I think it's important for us to have these conversations and for us as Asian people to be able to distinguish and not take whatever is spoon-fed us. Just because a movie like this has all Asian people in it does not mean I have to like it. Because the movie objectively sucked, it didn't touch upon morals and ideas that I struggle with personally as an Asian American, what other people may struggle with, right?
Yeah.
It is the white person's version of what they think Asian culture is, or Chinese culture in this particular context. That is why it's important to have diversity in the screenplay process, in the directing process, in the production process. White person, you can't just throw up Asian faces and say, this is diversity, right? We're seeing now diversity become a profitable term.
Mm-hmm.
Look, in the grand scheme of things, some things are done well, some things are not done so well. I mean, I love my Asian people, but that doesn't mean I love every Asian person, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, what's your opinion on that? Is that fair for me to just have that scrutiny towards a movie like this?
it is not wrong for you to think that way. In fact, I encourage that, and I implore our listeners to take on the same mentality, because the more we shut up and take it for what it is, the more erasure occurs in our own communities, because it's just a checkmark to Hollywood studios now.
Right.
Think about now, the Academy Awards, in order to win Best Picture, you have to check off certain checkboxes.
Yeah, yeah.
One POC, yeah. One, it's like, is that all we are to you?
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. And that may be a whole nother episode.
That's a whole nother episode. Yeah. That's something we could bring in your sister in.
Yeah.
But is that who we are to you? We're just a quota?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I urge Hollywood to look at us more than just scoring diversity points.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to take risks with other minorities and tell their stories as the minority would want the story to be told.
Then the question comes, what is good enough, right? And for me, I think the point is that it never is good enough, because when we take it as just because good, you know, when we take whatever it is good enough, again, we are at the definition of white America in terms of like, oh, you want Asian faces? Sure, here you go. Even if we got a Chinese director, here you go. The power dynamic stays the same though.
Yeah.
The definition doesn't change, and that is what I have an issue with.
My final thoughts on this topic, there's no end point. We're always going to need to work better, not just for our own communities, but supporting other communities as well.
Yeah.
Because if white America continues down this path of like, we're the default and we want to tell another community story, we're just going to bring one person on and then we'll kind of have like we'll draw the strings and everything. That's not diversity. That's not inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
That's just showcasing us as a way to profit.
Yeah. And last point I'll make is, we know that with COVID and China flu and Kung flu virus, our place in America is very conditional. A virus comes out of China and all of a sudden Asian people, there's an uptick of Asian American hate crimes.
Yep.
That to me is like, how have we really progressed that far?
Mm-hmm. You ever notice that when something bad happens to a marginalized community, Black, Brown, Asians, that
Latinx,
that one bad thing is attributed to the entire community.
Yep.
But when it's a white person doing it, it's like, oh, no, like that person is by themselves. Like, clearly that doesn't
represent. They have mental health issues, or mm-hmm. oh my God, they came up with a poor area. There's always some kind of excuse for it.
There's an excuse for it. And then it leaks into Hollywood, because now it's like, oh, this one Asian person likes honor, loyalty, whatever. The entire Asian population loves
that. That's what Asian people love now.
Exactly. But with white people, it's like, oh, they can be so nuanced in so many different areas. But I mean, one thing in one community means you paintbrush us?
Well, I think it's been a very robust conversation for sure. Thank you, Alan, for jumping on this. I hope we tackled enough. I think Mulan will probably continue to be dissected.
Thanks for having me, Raymond.